The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The Cypher Wheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CypherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CypherSafe.io to get the Cypher Wheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Noddle 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Noddle. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Noddle node, available at noddle.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin and Bitcoin only. Cold Card is basically a small computer that can only do Bitcoin, which makes securing it more straightforward. Use the code BitcoinStandard on coldcardwallet.com to get a 5% discount.
Hello and welcome to another seminar of the Bitcoin Standard podcast. In today's seminar, I thought I would like to discuss the topic of aviation, of all things, because I think it's highly relevant to Bitcoin and the creation of Bitcoin. And I think it also carries a lot of lessons that are relevant for thinking about the impact of hard money and sound money versus easy money. And it's something that I discuss in my next book, The Fiat Standard, which is now available for pre-order from SaferDean.com. So just go to SaferDean.com/TFS and you can pre-order a copy of The Fiat Standard now. You'll get the full draft of the book, which has been completed now, and the final printed copies will be out, and the digital copies and the audiobook will be out in December. So you can pre-order it right now from SaferDean.com. I had written a paper before becoming full-time in Bitcoin. The last paper that I wrote that was not Bitcoin-related was on aviation. In particular, it was the title of the paper was Slowdown, and it argued that aviation has essentially been slowing down and regressing technically since practically the 1970s. I think there was a strong contrast in the paper between how aviation worked when it was first invented in the early 20th century versus how it works now and how it worked after the 1970s, after the move off the gold standard. And I wasn't, it wasn't a monetary paper at that time, it was just contrasting them, but I think looking at it through the lens of monetary economics can be very telling. So the first and most interesting thing that you find about aviation in the if you look into the history is just how absolutely improbable and unforeseeable it was. In fact, you know, we take it for granted that you can just get on a machine and cross the Atlantic in a few hours. But up until 1903, the vast majority of people in the world thought this was impossible. And I don't mean by the vast majority, I don't just refer to people who lived in technologically primitive societies who couldn't envision this. I'm referring in particular to the most accomplished scientists of the day, as well as the media of the day. And so if you look at 1903, when the Wright brothers first flew, they flew in December of 1903, just a few months earlier, 2 months specifically, 2 months earlier in October 1903, the New York Times had published a typically snarky debunking of the possibility that airplanes can fly. And it was just an article reporting on another person who was trying to make flight work and who failed. And they reported on it with their usual trademark snarky, condescending style, which they still maintain until today. And in it, basically, they mocked the notion that you could have humans make machines that can fly. And they said, maybe if all of the world's mathematicians and mechanics dedicate themselves to this problem, perhaps in a million to 10 million years, we might be able to accomplish it. And lo and behold, it was only 2 months later that the Wright brothers accomplished this. Not only was it the New York Times who was dismissing this, Lord Kelvin, one of the most important scientists in the world, the temperature scale, the scientific temperature scale of Kelvin is named after him. He was a physicist and a polymath, and he did a whole bunch of important things. And he specifically said in 1896, he said, I have not the smallest molecule of faith in aerial navigation other than ballooning or the expectation of good results from any of the trials we heard of. Another important scientist of the day, Simon Newcomb, in 1903 also said, aerial flight is one of the class of problems with which man will never be able to cope. That was just completely out of the question that human beings could fly. And indeed, they did fly. In fact, of course, you know, at that time, the Wright brothers didn't have a video camera to capture their flight with them. And, you know, working a camera was almost as complicated as working an airplane at that time. So they didn't have video recordings of their flight. And so it took a while for the world to believe that flight had actually taken place, so much so that in 1906, the London Times had dismissed, you know, they'd said there'd been a lot of people who have been claiming to fly, but none of this is obviously none of this is true, because all attempts at, and I quote, all attempts at artificial aviation are not only dangerous to human life, but foredoomed to failure from the engineering standpoint. This was basically the setting for the invention of the airplane. It was something that was considered completely impossible. And everybody who was an expert on all of the things related to aviation at that time, which were viewed as issues that related to aviation, everybody thought this can't be done, you know, and they had very good reason why it can't be done. You need this and you need that and we can't have it. And things that are human beings are heavy and you can't just make a machine that will be able to lift them above the air. And all of these complicated scientists had extremely complicated reasons for why this just couldn't work. And yet, it did. Now, interestingly enough, And I'm going to come back to the genesis, but this trend continued even further. So one of the Wright brothers himself, a few years after the flight, after the airplane had been invented and then the world had taken notice and the world was beginning to copy and use airplanes, and people were starting to make better airplanes with better range that were flying longer distances. And then some people started mentioning the possibility of crossing the Atlantic with an airplane. And one of the Wright brothers said, cross-Atlantic flight is not going to happen. We're not going to be able to cross the Atlantic on an airplane. Airplanes are not made to cross the Atlantic. And yet, lo and behold, it was only a few years later that the airplane managed to cross the Atlantic. And now airplanes cross the Atlantic hundreds of times, maybe every day. It's astonishing. You know, in 1913, he said, Alvin Wright, Orville Wright, in 1913, he said, nope, it can't be happened. And 5 years later, in 1918, it happened. So the history of aviation was always full of just people, of a majority of people who said it can't be done, and then a couple of crazy people who just go ahead and pull it off and actually make it happen. And initially, again, there was a lot of skepticism about the possibility that you could make commercial aviation work. People said, all right, we can build these tiny little planes that'll carry one person long distances, but obviously you can't build an airplane that could be used for carrying passengers or large amounts of luggage. That just can't be done. And guess what? 1926, commercial aviation was a thing. So it only took 23 years from the invention of the airplane until commercial aviation was happening. And during that time, that too was being dismissed as something that was completely unrealistic. But it did happen. And another example was the sound barrier. As airplanes started getting better and faster, they continued to get faster and faster and faster. But then they started hitting the sound barrier, which is defined as 1 Mach, and 1 Mach in speed, which is, I think, I forget the exact number in kilometers per second. I'll look it up.
It's 343 meters per second.
Yeah, do you know by kilometers per hour?
1,234 kilometers per hour.
Okay, 1,200?
And that's 767 miles per hour.
Okay, yeah. All right, So the speed of light is 767 miles per hour, and that was just completely unfathomable initially. You know, the first flight, the Wright brothers flew at a speed of 6 miles per hour. It was basically a glorified kite, and the notion that you could travel on that glorified kite at a speed faster than sound was just absurd. But in 1912, somebody managed to fly at 100 miles per hour. In 1921, somebody did 200 miles per hour. And then in 1931, somebody did 400 miles per hour. Now, suddenly these airplane things started looking more than just glorified kites. They were going really fast. 400 miles per hour is really, really, really fast. They became significantly faster than cars and airplanes. And so for commercial aviation, it started to make sense. But then in the 1930s and 40s, it was clear that there was just going to be a limit where we won't be able to cross the sound barrier. The sound barrier is just too high at 767. And for many years, a lot of people had tried, but they would arrive at that speed. And then the pressure of trying to cross the speed barrier would be too high on the aircraft, and the aircrafts couldn't handle it. And so it was assumed that, nope, we're never going to be able to cross the sound barrier. And yet in 1947, a manned aircraft finally broke the sound barrier. And then from then on, the speed just shot up from the 1940s until the 1970s. Yeah, and then in 1976, July 28th, funnily enough, it is actually the anniversary of it today. It's 55 years to the day that this flight speed record has stood, that was broken and has stood. It's been 55 years exactly since an airplane has broken the speed record. Nobody has been able to break that SR-71's record, which is was at that time 2,193 miles per hour, or 3,529 kilometers per hour, which is an astonishing speed. It is a Mach 3.3, so it's 3.3 times the speed of sound, which is enormous. And also on that very same day, another SR-71, they were just breaking records that day, and one of the SR-71s managed to fly to a record altitude of 85,069 feet, to 25,929 meters, which still stands as the highest altitude record. So it's been 55 years now since the record has been broken for speed and altitude of aviation. And but since then, everything has gone downhill. And again, I recommend looking at the website, what the F happened in, WTF happened in 1971. A lot of things started to go to shit in the 1970s, and aviation is one of them. So not only was, I should add one more thing, not only was the sound barrier broken, but then we were able to build commercial airlines, commercial aviation that was supersonic. And so the Concorde jet first flew in the 1960s, I think. The Concorde jet first flew in the
1976.
Yes, 1976.
Sorry, first flight 1969.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah, it flew in the first time in 1969 or 1968 in my notes. But then the first commercial flight, when it was deployed commercially, was in 1976. So the same year in which this flight speed record was broken. That really was the pinnacle of human engineering in my mind, I think. The technologies of the gold standard era, the airplane and the engine, were utilized over the 60 years since the gold standard ended in 1914. And by 1971, basically, the final move off gold had just caused us to continue to degrade technologically. So 1976, this is engineering, so there's a long lead time. So in the 1950s and 60s, they were working on making supersonic flight happen commercially. It happened in 1976. But here's the interesting thing. Since then, it hasn't happened again. It's now been 55 years since the Concorde was introduced, and there has not been a faster commercial airline and airliner introduced since then, which is quite astonishing when you think about it. There's really no reason why we shouldn't be getting faster and better at doing all of those things. And in fact, not only have we not made a better Concorde, but also we've decommissioned the Concorde. There is no Concorde anymore. You can't fly a Concorde. And it's pretty astonishing when you think about it that people could cross the Atlantic faster in the 1970s than they can today. It's something that people don't like to think about because, we like to think that everything is great and progress is amazing and everything today is better than it was yesterday. And, sure, when we cross the Atlantic today, we have amazing plastic toys in our hands and iPhones that have incredible games on them and incredible screen resolution, and we can broadcast our thoughts to the entire planet. The telecommunication revolution has been amazing. Still doesn't change the fact that you could cross the Atlantic in 3 or 4 hours back in the 1970s. Now you need 7 or 8 hours flying in subsonic airplanes, which is also quite interesting. So we see this world where we have this story of aviation from 1903 until 1976, in which it's just one miracle after the other and one expert getting slapped in the face after the other. And then we see a different story from 1976 until today, where things just continue to get worse every day. The quality continues to decline. Things don't get better. By the objective metrics, we see that aviation today can't match up to aviation back then. So there are three ways in which we can see this happening. Number one, we see First of all, there's no supersonic flight, as I mentioned. Secondly, we can't break the speed record, as I mentioned earlier. There hasn't been a faster jet than the SR-71. The SR-71 itself was decommissioned in 1991. It was decommissioned then, and then since then, you know, the replacement is the F-35. The fastest aircraft that the U.S. Army has today is the F-35, which is not as fast as the SR-77. It's significantly slower. So we've declined in terms of the peak performance. And also, interestingly enough, we've also declined in terms of the speed of commercial aviation, even the subsonic aviation. So even putting aside supersonic aviation, if you look at, and I did this for that paper, I went through the 10 most popular routes in the United States in 2016. Chicago to New York, Los Angeles to San Francisco, Chicago to Los Angeles, Los Angeles to New York, Atlanta, Chicago, Atlanta, New York, Miami, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Chicago, Minneapolis, and Atlanta to Orlando. These are the 10 most popular routes in the US. And I looked at estimated flight duration for these flights today. You know, you just check on any search engine and see how long the flights are. And so I wrote the time in minutes. And then I found airline schedules and airline brochures from the 1960s and 70s. In particular, I looked at 1969, 71, and 72. These were the years for which I could find data for these routes. And I looked at the time, the expected time for these flights back then. And it was a really interesting exercise. And what I found is that, and I did it for both legs of the flight, so Chicago to LA and then LA to Chicago. And then you look at the times and you see every single one of those routes is now slower than what it was before. The expected time for each one of these is slower. In fact, today, the average route in 2016, not today, this was 2016 when I did this, is 18.45% slower than what it was in 1969, 71, or 72. So 50 years later, or a little less than 50 years, 47 years later, airplanes are going 18% slower. Commercial airlines are taking longer to get there. And the reasons for that are, I think, twofold. First, now there's an emphasis on fuel efficiency in flight, and so they're telling the pilots to try and fly not very fast, but fly at the most fuel efficient level. And back then they didn't care, you know, they had hard money, and so things weren't expensive, and well, relatively hard money in the 60s, but you know, they hadn't gone off gold completely, and the 1970s inflation had not started. And so the focus was on performance. And so they were just telling the pilots to go as fast as they can. And so on average, it means that today we're 18% slower. So, and I think the other aspect of it is that airports today are more crowded. And so getting your airplane from the gate to takeoff now takes longer because airports are much more crowded. So we're not building enough airports to keep up with the demand to the point that the customer experience is degrading and the airplanes are not traveling as fast. So in all of these aspects, we see that aviation has just taken on a totally different face since the 1970s. The military is no longer interested in making faster aircraft. Commercial airliners no longer want to build. Nobody talks about building a supersonic jet. And the Concorde has been decommissioned and nobody wants to discuss why. And, people very rarely discuss why. Generally, they'll just mention, oh, well, it wasn't economical. There wasn't enough money. And I think that's just completely nonsensical. If you think about just how much a lot of people would pay to save 3 hours on a cross-Atlantic trip, I think it's unfathomable that this market option is not available. I mean, a lot of people pay a lot of money already on business class flights, and yet they still can't get very quickly. A lot of people use private jets, and that costs a lot of money, and they still can't cross the Atlantic very quickly. In fact, you know, the example that I like to give is, think of the, if you think of the, professional athletes, like somebody like Lionel Messi. He plays for the Argentinian national team. He'll have his games with the Argentinian national team usually in Latin America when he's playing World Cup qualifiers or Copa America or whatever. And then he has to go back to Europe, play with Barcelona in Spain within a few days. So you're talking about somebody who's getting paid tens of millions of dollars a year to play football. And spending time on an airplane is not good for him. It can make him exhausted, and it compromises his performance. It's well known as an issue for football players. Just imagine how much Barcelona FC, his club, would be willing to pay for flights that could take him from Buenos Aires to Barcelona in 3 hours or 4 hours, rather than eight or nine as it currently stands, I presume. So I'm sure there's a lot of money for it. And the Concorde was profitable. It wasn't losing money. It was a political problem. This paper was written in 2016 before the corona hysteria happened. But I think it's it touches on something that we see, which is just the triumph of the Karens, the triumph of the negative people who just want to stop you doing things because it gets their knickers in a twist for some stupid reason or the other. And so with supersonic flight, there was a lot of campaigning, a lot of bad publicity around it because people were just uncomfortable with the fact that it was burning so much oil to cross the Atlantic. And so environmentalists were widely opposed to Concorde. And that was, to a large extent, helping drive the companies that had built it, which was a consortium, a British and French consortium. And it was commissioned essentially by British Airways and Air France. So those two companies basically got taken over by managers who were not interested in continuing to work on the Concorde. They didn't want to improve it. They didn't want to build new ones. And they just decided to start decommissioning them. And the track record, I think, also is not an excuse. Yes, there was one accident with the Concorde, but if you measure the track record, it still has a better track record than other airplanes, which have accidents all the time. Well, not all the time, but the Concorde operated from 1976 until 2000, and I can't remember, sometime in the early 2000s, so that would have been about 25, 30 years or so. And it had one accident. That was it. During that time, regular airplanes had many, many more accidents. Now, the interesting thing is, if you compare this kind of mentality of the Karens and also the listen to the experts and listen to the science mentality, which is, you know, people are happily flying on airplanes and they're happily paying for the experience. And then an expert comes in and says, oh, no, actually, you can't fly this because, you know, that's bad. Then it burns fuel, and burning fuel is going to boil the oceans and it's going to cause the planet to fall apart or whatever is the latest hysteria. And it's quite amazing, because what triggered this this entire discussion today is a tweet that I saw yesterday on Twitter. Obviously, it's a tweet from Paul Graham, who is from Y Combinator, a startup funding company. And Paul Graham is, by all means, a very intelligent person who's built a lot more companies and financed a lot more companies than I ever will. And I will confess and admit that, you know, it is kind of awkward for me to be dissing him when he's built probably a lot more than I ever will build in my life. But that's not going to stop me anyway, because, you know, just because he builds stuff doesn't mean he's infallible. But I think his tweet was quite informative of this kind of mentality shift that we see. Because what he was saying is, if you think you don't trust scientists, you're mistaken. You trust scientists in a million different ways every time you step on a plane, or for that matter, turn on your tap or open a can of beans. The fact that you're unaware of this doesn't mean it's not so. Which I think are three very interesting examples to use about why to trust scientists. And the one that I know very well is, and the reason that I pounced on this is because, you know, in this paper, I'd looked at the history of aviation and I'd seen how scientists were out there essentially saying, trust the experts, listen to the science, stop trying to fly, kids. You're only going to get yourself hurt. And that was what the science said. So in fact, if people had listened to Paul Graham in 1903, they would not have been attempting flight. And the Wright brothers would have been in their bike shed. Because the Wright brothers were not scientists. They were by no means professional scientists. They were employing the scientific method while building their airplane, that's for sure. But they were high school dropouts who were bicycle mechanics. They had a bicycle shop. That's what they did. They worked in building bicycles. And in their spare time, they took a bunch of the bike material and figured out how to try to build an airplane. And they would go to a field outside their town and they'd try and make the airplanes fly. And, you know, they weren't the only ones. There were a lot of people at that time who were trying to make airplanes fly. And a lot of them were getting killed all the time in accidents while trying to build this. But it was only because they didn't listen to the science. You know, in 1903, Lord Kelvin was saying this is impossible. Newcomb was saying this is impossible. The New York Times was debunking the possibility of flight and using sophisticated physics to explain why, you know, all of these idiots trying to fly in North Carolina and Ohio and all of that are doomed to failure. It was all the scientists agree. And so you had to be a heretic to go and try and make an airplane fly. And thankfully, back in 1903, we had a lot of heretics. And I'm sure if we looked into all kinds of other inventions that were taking place at that time, we would find very similar stories. We'd find the experts saying, no, this can't be done. I tried to do it. It didn't work because of X, and therefore it can't be done. Stop wasting your time, you stupid little kids, and just listen to the science. And then the kids go ahead and build it. And in fact, the examples are numerous. And I think it's very telling that this kind of mentality was not successful in getting people to shut up and stop trying to do crazy things back in 1903. But it has been very successful recently, since the 1970s, in shutting people down. And I think the fact that somebody as creative and as intelligent as Paul Graham falls for this scam, I can think of it as a scam, is very telling. I mean, this is somebody who's really helped, you know, he has the sort of vision. I don't really know what his track record is exactly like, but I'm sure he's financed companies like Uber and Airbnb, which is quite disruptive, you know, to take a chance on a company like Uber. I'm not sure if he was actually involved with that, but maybe Facebook as well. But, you know, to be an early investor on something like this, to put a lot of money into financing a company like that, obviously today it looks like it was a no-brainer, you know. Everybody thinks, oh, if I knew about Uber back when he knew about Uber, I would definitely have invested and I'd be rich too today. Maybe, maybe not. But there was another 1,000 companies like Uber that you had to sift through in order to find the Uber and invest in it. And now, in hindsight, it's easy to see that Uber is successful and was a good investment. But back then, it didn't really make, you know, there was another 1,000 ideas that could have been successful and they didn't. So it's not very easy to pick those things. So this is clearly somebody who's been very successful at the job of a VC, which is a truly visionary job. You know, you look at the world, you look at the hotel industry, for instance, and you think, yep, this is how it works. We've had hotels working for so many years, and this is how it's done. But I think we can improve on that by having people host people in their own home. We can make a lot of efficiency improvements, and that would be extremely valuable. This would be a multi-billion dollar company. So it takes a lot of courage and a lot of vision to do this. And yet, he still thinks in terms of listen to the science. The scientists are saying things and you should just listen to scientists and you should trust scientists. And of course, you know, it's no coincidence that he happens to be also one of the people who has been extremely hysterical about coronavirus. And he's got a famous tweet he keeps retweeting about the nature of exponential growth is such that the best time to panic is when it's too early, which is pretty ironic that he's still proud of that statement now, because it's been 18 months and people are still panicking. And, you know, they panicked early and they're panicking late and they're still panicking just because the science says you should panic. And I think there comes a point where you need to be a little bit more critical in your thinking and employ a little bit of Wright brother thinking and just think, yeah, you know what? Panicking hasn't helped anybody. All of the stupid things that the panickers have asked people to do have been counterproductive, likely. What does actually help is not panicking, not losing your mind, maintaining your health, eating well, getting sunshine, getting exercise, staying strong, staying healthy. That's going to help you much more than anything else you could do. And but of course, that's not very popular in Silicon Valley, because, you know, a lot of people are going to have a lot of ideas about how to milk the corona hysteria for profit. So and a lot of people have the, you know, even though they're very creative people, they still have the listen to the science bug. They've still caught that. And that, I think, is very, very interesting. I think you cannot separate that from the distinction between hard money and easy money. And I discussed this in the Bitcoin Standard briefly, where I talk about just the amount of innovation that happened in the 19th century. You know, you think about it, the things that the gold standard gave us, it's one of the most ridiculous things that Keynesians say is, well, if we didn't have monetary expansion, if we didn't have inflation, we wouldn't be able to finance so much innovation. You know, look at all the innovation that we have. And in fact, look at all the innovation that we have. Look at all the most important life-changing technologies that we have today. They were all invented under the gold standard, almost all of them. The telegraph and the phone and the computer as well. The predecessor to the computer was invented back in the 19th century. The airplane, the car, the elevator, the subway, and an enormous number of medical inventions and all kinds of other inventions were invented in that golden period when the whole world was on a gold standard, in the late 19th century, basically. Well, the mid-19th century, late 19th century, also early 19th century as well. But it was invented by countries that were on a gold standard. So how did all of those people manage to make all of these inventions without an inflationary money printer to give them money, you know? Well, the answer is because there was no inflationary money printer to give them money, that meant two things. That meant that there was no inflation to finance people like Kelvin and Newcomb to go around and, you know, shut down aviation and ban it and make it illegal because it is dangerous. Because they didn't have a lot of money, because there was no magic money printer that could finance all of the Karens and the negative Nancys who would want to shut everything down, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, the fact that you had a hard money means that people like the Wright brothers, you know, two bike mechanics, could, in their spare time, on their weekend, with their savings, invent airplanes. It's mind-blowing. When was the last thing you invented an airplane? When was the last time anybody you know invented something like the airplane in their spare time with their own savings? If you think about it, you know, they weren't financed by VCs. They weren't financed by inflation. They didn't get a massive loan from the bank in order to invest in the airplane. They built the airplane first. They flew first. They made it work, and then they looked into commercializing it and making money off of it. And they did. But it's very different from how things happen right now. Because right now, you know, think about the possibility of inventing something. It's going to require you to take some serious time, and it's going to require some resources. And the vast majority of people don't have any resources. They don't have savings that they can just put into things. Most people live hand to mouth, basically. A lot of very rich people live hand to mouth. There really are people who earn a seven-digit income, and they still live hand to mouth. And, you know, they spend everything they earn, and they barely have any savings. That kind of person today, because of the fact that money is broken, because of the fact that money can't hold its value, they can't have savings, they don't keep savings, they have no incentive to save, they spend all of their money, and therefore they have no spare time. They can't take a week off from work, because if they take a week off from work, they don't eat, no matter how much they get paid. And so they can't have the schedule or the savings or even the mental clarity to think about, you know, maybe I could be the one who could invent flight. They don't have the kind of luxury and freedom to just ignore what the New York Times says about flight, because who cares about what the New York Times says? You know, there are a bunch of people sitting in an office in New York writing. They don't know about what it would take to fly something in a field in North Carolina. But that kind of mentality is what was existing in the gold standard era. This is how the telephone and the telegram and all kinds of amazing inventions were invented. It was people who were tinkering in their own backyard or in their own garage, playing with their things that they could buy from their savings. And the vast majority of those people were failed at building the things that they wanted to build. You know, the vast majority of people who tried to build the airplane failed. But some of them succeeded, and the ones who succeeded changed the world. So that kind of optionality of people being able to have savings and being able to use those savings in order to invest in something that they like and then come up with an incredible and new invention, I think this is much less likely to be seen today, because you see most people are just stuck in office jobs having to pay their bills because nobody has savings. And on the other side, you know, the flip side of the coin of you not having savings is that wealth is allocated by fiat, by the government that owns the printing press, and it gets allocated to the Lord Kelvins and the Simon Newcombs who go around and tell you, you can't do this, you can't do that. And I think it's... that money has been allocated so effectively over the last 50 years that scientists or professional science, university science, has essentially brainwashed generations of people into thinking that the reason that we have all these incredible inventions is because of science. You know, the reason that the airplane flies is because we have physicists who are able to make all of these fancy, incredible equations and theories about physics that allow the airplane to fly. Wrong. That's not how that works. Physics was completely settled. The science was settled in physics that airplanes can't fly. You know, they had their equations, they had their models and theories about it, and it was clear among all the physicists that lived in 1903, or maybe not all, but I think a majority of them would have agreed with Lord Kelvin that this is just not going to happen. And it wasn't the physicist who built the airplane. It was the Wright brothers. The Wright brothers were bike mechanics. They were the ones who didn't listen to the experts. They did not trust the science. And that's why we have airplanes today. And in fact, I really very strongly recommend a book by Terence Keady that is called The Economic Laws of Scientific Research. And it's a really, really, really important book. And I quote this in the Bitcoin standard. And I mention it in the fiat standard. It's a really powerful book. Keeley is one of the very few British professors who is not government financed. He works at Buckingham University, which is one of the last remaining private universities in the UK. And not being a fiat professor means that he has very different perspective on things than most fiat professors. And this book is absolutely mind-blowing. So he discusses the Industrial Revolution and how the Industrial Revolution came about. And of course, you know, the thing that you hear about from your university professors, from your fiat university professors who are financed by their government and who speak in the official name of science and who can issue declarations on things, they will have you believe that the reason that we have the Industrial Revolution is because of the advancement in chemistry and physics. In fact, the reason that we have the Industrial Revolution is because of barely literate ironmongers and technicians and workers who got their hand dirty and were just trying to solve problems on the real world, in the real world. They were trying to make things better for themselves. So I think, you know, perhaps the most important invention in the last 1,000 years might arguably be the steam engine. You could argue a few others. There are a bunch of good ones, but I think the steam engine really is the pivotal in my mind, because it was the one invention where we managed to start turning fossil fuel energy into, you know, cheap, highly abundant dirt under the earth. We started to turn this into kinetic energy. We started getting it to do work for us. And eventually, you know, obviously the steam engines continued to improve over time. And then we made the internal combustion engine. And then we made jet engines. And now engines are extremely efficient and extremely powerful. And there are billions and billions of glorious, powerful engines all over the world currently allowing you to experience all the amazing things that you take for granted in your life. I think the steam engine is the most important invention because it was the turning point. It was the moment at which we took fossil fuel energy and turned it into kinetic energy. And then once we did that, then the floodgates were open. And then the floodgates were open both conceptually because, oh, maybe we can burn things in a different way and produce kinetic energy in a different way. But also the floodgates were opened from an engineering sense, because now with the steam engine, you can build all kinds of other stuff. And because you could build all kinds of other stuff, you could build all kinds of amazing new inventions. So you could argue the computer is more important than the steam engine. Perhaps, perhaps not, but the computer would not be possible without the steam engine. If we hadn't invented the steam engine first, we would not have been able to develop the computer. So all of the machines that we have really ultimately come down to the steam engine. Arguably, it might be the most important thing that we've invented since fire. Or maybe language. It's tough to say with these things. But yeah, the steam engine is a big deal. So let's take a look at the steam engine. And in the Economic Laws of Scientific Research, Keeley does a great job looking at the steam engine and explaining its history. So the first thing you realize is this, what is called the linear model of scientific progress, which is taught at universities and is essentially government propaganda, it argues that, you know, you have the smartest people in any society gather in a university, and then they talk to each other and come up with theories, and they develop a scientific knowledge, and then they use that knowledge in order to bring about improvements in practical products, and then they communicate these to people who work in professional sides of business, in business and building products, and then they start developing these new technologies. And it's as if, you know, the scientific progress comes from the scientist and then finds its way to the engine shop and then spreads to the consumer. But the reality of how those things have always developed is very different. The reality is the person developing and the person making the breakthroughs is somebody who's out there dealing with these practical machines day in and day out and having problems with its operation and thinking of ways to solve these problems. This is how it happens. It's problem solving on the ground. It's getting your hands dirty with engines. And so the first commercial steam engine, well, first of all, the steam engine was essentially a development of a pump. Pumps had existed and people were using pumps, and then they started adding more and more features to it. And then at some point, it's not very clear where we draw the line between pump and engine, but at some point we have something that we can call a steam engine. And so in that case, we see that the first commercial steam engine, you know, the first steam engine that got bought by anybody with the purpose of using the steam engine for productive work was produced by a guy called Newcomen. And Newcomen was a barely literate ironmonger, Simon Newcomen. This was in the 18th century. And he couldn't really read. He could barely read and write. And he'd never met a scientist in his life. He had never met a scientist. He'd never been to a university. You're talking about essentially low-class, low-pay worker who was out there dealing with pumps all day. And he was an ironmonger, so he knew how to turn iron into different shapes and make different things out of it. And, you know, you can get into the details of how he did it, but at some point he figured out that this could be a very useful thing. He did it, he built it, and it was so useful that a lot of people wanted it. And he built 300 models of this thing. There were 300 Newcomen engines that were deployed in different places across England when he did it. Nothing in happening in the universities of England had anything to do with this. This was just basic, ugly technology on the ground, and the scientists had nothing to do with it. James Watt, who is usually credited with being the inventor of the modern steam engine, because he really built the thing that is closest to what we have. Although I think arguably his role is likely a little overstated, and his role is due to the fact that he was the first one to patent, I think, the engine. And in the process, he ended up slowing development in the engine by being a patent troll and preventing people from building their own versions and so on. But in any case, James Watt was not a scientist. He's had the watt unit of power named after him. So when you hear the word kilowatt hour, that's that watt there is from James Watt, the inventor of the steam engine. And he was a technician at the University of, I think, Glasgow or Edinburgh. He was a technician, he was not a scientist. And after he invented the steam engine, he was asked whether he had benefited from or whether he was inspired by the equations of Richard Boyle or some other scientist or the other. And he said, nope, that had nothing to do with it. I was just in the workshop and I figured out how to build things. And I think this is really very telling. You look all around through the history of science and technology, and there's a good book on this that is called Serendipity by Robert Merton. People might know Robert Merton from the long-term capital management fund, which blew up. And he has the Nobel Prize in economics because of his work on the Black-Scholes model, which blew up and caused a huge disaster. But that's his father. His father was a sociologist. And he wrote this book called Serendipity, which was actually a very interesting book. And it shows just how much of scientific discoveries and technological innovations happened like that. It was just people playing around with things, and then they discovered that, oh, wait, look, this thing can do that. That sounds like it might be useful. Or people trying to find a solution for a problem and then chancing a technique for doing it, which ends up being useful for something else. So a lot of it is serendipity, and it's not, and it really defies the thing that we usually hear from universities about this just being, the linear top-down model where government finances scientists, scientists produce important research. The important research is then applied by engineers into their workshops in order to build products, and then the consumer benefits from it. It's entirely the other way around. The engineers are working at serving the consumer and are constantly receiving feedback from users in terms of, this is good, this is bad, I don't like this, I like this, could you make this faster, could you make this bigger, could you make this power more powerful? And they're constantly trying to improve. And from these attempts, the vast majority obviously fail, but the few ones that succeed get copied by everyone and change the world. That's how things worked under hard money. So Keeley's book is incredible because it explains just how much this is this has been the case for scientific innovation, how little role has been played in the Industrial Revolution by scientific theories, and how much of an important and how little of a role was played by government financing. In fact, Britain, which witnessed the Industrial Revolution, had exactly zero public funding for science. Public funding for science did not exist before 1914 in Britain. It was exactly in 1914 with the start of World War I, and when they went off the gold standard, that they started saying, oh yeah, we need to have the government finance education. We need to have the government finance science. Before that, they developed the entire Industrial Revolution without the government having to finance any scientists. And since then, what has Britain invented? You know, what has Britain really done in the past 100 years since going off the gold standard? And how does it compare to what Britain did in the 200 years before that on the gold standard? So we have the steam engine and an infinite number of enormously important and useful products back then in the past 200 years. And what do we have in the last 100 years? The Concorde, yeah, I think that was probably it. But still, the Concorde was just an improvement on aviation technology that was invented in before 1914. It was invented on the gold standard. So in this regard, it's quite telling that you see the majority of and the most important innovations come in the gold standard, and you see them come through the market process. And now that can only make me wonder, you know, looking at the world that we have today, just how much more innovations and how much more important innovations could we have had in the last 100 years if we hadn't taken the globally idiotic move of going off the gold standard? If the world was still on a gold standard until today, if everybody could still save, if everybody could be reasonably sure that they can save money and that would appreciate at around 1%, 2%, or 3% per year, and everybody, and we had governments that couldn't finance all of these negative Nancys and Karens like Lord Kelvin and all of these people who are just out there to take government paychecks and to tell you that what you're trying to do is unworkable. If we didn't have that, it's truly amazing to think about just what the possibilities would be for the world today, like where we would be and how different life would be. I think it might probably not be an exaggeration to say that the things that we developed in that we have today might have been developed by the 1960s and 70s. You know, we might have had smartphones by the 60s. I think it's not an entirely unreasonable thing to do. When you think about just how much capital has been destroyed and how much innovation has been forestalled by fiat, taking money away from savers, making them more financially vulnerable and necessitating that they continue to work and that they not have the time to tinker in their backyard like the Wright brothers did. When you think about all the money that goes to finance scientists rather than, you know, think about all the taxes. Here's a way of putting it. You know, the Simon Newcomen and James Watt in a fiat world, they would have been paying the much higher taxes and they'd been paying the inflation tax that goes to finance the university professors that were sitting there and pontificating about all of these things and how they can't be done. The Wright brothers in 1903 would have not had savings, and those savings would have been going to pay for the scientists that were calling them unrealistic. I think it's, you know, I don't, it's obviously hard to argue what the counterfactual is because we don't know. We'll never be able to relive the 20th century with hard money. But it's hard to see all of these patterns and argue that they would have been insignificant. To argue that, you know, if a century of taking away the savings of the Wright brothers and financing Lord Kelvin's has not reduced our ability to innovate, it's very hard to make that argument, I think. And interestingly, I think also another important point here worth mentioning is that the improvements of the Industrial Revolution, I don't think they're just important for the obvious industrial and quality of life reasons that we see. I think they were massively important for medical and health improvements. There's pretty good evidence, and I'll post an article that I've read about this at some point, that suggests sanitation and electricity and running hot water and just not living next to our feces has had a far bigger impact on human health than any of the medical interventions that are supposedly hailed as miracles. In particular, you know, draining swamps and draining trash, draining swamps away from drinking water, simply just separating drinking water from wastewater, wastewater management is probably responsible for more of the health improvements of the 20th century than anything else. And this is something that was beginning to be done in the modern, highly productive way toward the late 19th century, thanks to fossil fuels and thanks to hydroelectric energy, hydrocarbon energy in particular, because it allowed us to build all these incredible engines that could move water around and that could treat water and that could prevent our waste from entering into our drinking water. And this massively boosted life expectancy and health outcomes in many, many different ways. I think it is arguably far more important than any of the medical interventions that are usually credited for this. It's hugely underrated how important modern industrial technology and civilization has been for our lives. So, and of course, it's underrated by the scientists. It's underrated by the people who are telling you to trust them. So it's I think it's quite telling. And of course, the obvious point where I'm going with all of this is to bring it back to Bitcoin. It's been an hour of ranting in order to get to the point on Bitcoin. The reason I think Bitcoin fixes this is Well, I think Bitcoin fixes this because Satoshi was very similar to the Wright brothers. I think the invention of Bitcoin is just an excellent example of something that we haven't seen for a long time. Perhaps we haven't seen it as starkly demonstrated since the Wright brothers, which is something all the experts agree cannot work. And just like with the Wright brothers, you know, it was 3 years after, it was maybe 4 or 5 years after they actually flew that the world came to accept the fact that, yep, they did fly indeed. Similarly with Bitcoin, you know, it's now been 12 years and people still deny Bitcoin. People still think, no, it can't work. It's going to go to zero. It's unworkable. It's going to be shut down. Government is going to turn it off one day with the magic internet switch that they have. It's really very similar. If you look at the deranged no-coiners and the hate that Bitcoiners get and the hate that Bitcoin as a concept gets, it's very similar to aviation. You know, we had all these very important scientists back then who had staked their names and reputation on airplanes not working. And we have all these self-important economists today who have staked their names and reputations on Bitcoin not working. And guess what? They're all getting wrecked, basically, by the airplane working and Bitcoin working. And it's, I think it's the best counter to Paul Graham, which is, no, you shouldn't trust the scientists because that's just a complete oxymoron. Science is a process of experimentation. It's not reliance on authority. And it's very telling that when he wants to give us examples of why we should trust the science, he can't even think of an actual example of somebody listening to a scientist and benefiting. I mean, I'm sure there have been scientists that have done good things to the world, and there have been people who have listened to the scientists and benefited from it. You could find examples, I'm sure you can. And yet, when he wants to come up with an example, the example that he comes up with is something that is the exact opposite of listening to the science. The airplane was only possible because people didn't listen to the science. And the other examples he brings, when you turn on a tap, plumbing, again, that was not something discovered in some university lab. It's something that we've had for thousands of years, and engineers have been improving upon it incrementally for thousands of years. And then the tin can, opening a can. And that's maybe the most absurd because, you know, there are no laboratories at universities that are out there trying to discover how to make tin cans. Tin cans and can openers were discovered by merchants and entrepreneurs and ironmongers and people who work with the tin and so on. And they figured out, hey, we could preserve food by locking it in this thing. And then others tried it and they didn't die and the food still worked. And so then it became popular. So all of these examples come from people in not listening to the science, not trusting the experts, and going out there and actually building something that works. That's how you got all of those things to happen. And that's how I think Bitcoin really worked. And I think Bitcoin fixes this because it's a way of coming up with, it's bringing back that idea. And I think the internet is really the place where we see it, because it's very hard to be able to be a Wright brother with physical stuff, because physical stuff is very expensive because we're all being robbed by inflation all the time. But it's kind of easy to be a Wright brother with internet stuff, with digital stuff, because you just need a laptop and then you can build, and then the government is going to be far slower about finding out what you're doing. So we see Uber is still operating, and it's been so many years. I don't know how many years they've been around, but they're still operating, even though a lot of people would have thought that government would shut all of this down. Bitcoin is still working. In the world of technology, in the world of digital stuff, it's very difficult to stop code. So this is one way. And then the second way in which Bitcoin fixes this, of course, is that Bitcoin essentially and beautifully defunds the people who live off of government money, defunds the people who are the experts. It makes it very, very hard to maintain a plutocracy of or an oligopoly of scientists who get to tell us what the truth is. The only reason we have this right now, I think, is fiat. And it's fiat financing of universities that has corrupted the scientific process, which I discuss extensively in the Fiat Standard. And by defunding that, I think Bitcoin is going to bring back a golden age of innovation, by shutting up the experts and definancing them and making them have to do productive things with their life and provide valuable services because they won't be able to rely on a money printer. On the one hand, it's defunding the experts. And on the other hand, it's putting savings in the hands of the Wright brothers of today. It's letting all people all over the world manage to keep their savings, allowing them financial security and allowing them to be able to invest their time in doing creative things. You know, if you look at how much more creative energy you see from Bitcoiners in terms of innovation, I think it's not a coincidence. I see it in myself personally, and I think it's something that a lot of people talk about in the Bitcoin space, because once you've moved from the world in which you have your money is being devalued and the money is constantly losing value, you're constantly discounting the future a lot, and so your actions are dedicated and focused on day-to-day to survival, and there's very little regard for the future. As soon as you switch to a Bitcoin standard, as soon as you start holding Bitcoin, you start seeing you're able to provide for your future reliably well. You know that the savings that you save today will be around tomorrow, and they'll likely be at a higher price than what they are today. And with that in mind, you start discounting the future more and you start thinking about the future more. Sorry, you start discounting the future less and you think about the future more and you provide for it more and you work for it. And you start working on things that are not fleeting and day to day, and you start working on things that will last. And this was kind of my inspiration for writing the Bitcoin Standard. Before that, before I was a Bitcoiner, I probably wouldn't have been able to complete the book because I didn't have the time preference to sit down and actually write a book. So it's a wonderful thing that Bitcoin fixes this. And it's an amazing thing that, you know, I think on a Bitcoin Standard, people are going to just laugh at the idea that one day people seriously said, listen to the science and trust the science and trust the experts. It's a ridiculous idea.
Are you just taking a breath, Saif? Or are you...
I think I'm done.
I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
I don't mean to trigger you and fire you off into a rant, but I fear it might. I hope it kind of does. But with regards to, you know, what's going on right now with our incumbent billionaires and this kind of potty space race that's going on with the likes of Bezos and Branson of recent times, and of course our old friend Musk, how have you been thinking about that? And tying that all back in with the Wright brothers, who obviously come from, you know, building a bicycle shop, you know, arguably Bezos built, you know, Amazon with his own bare hands. And in my opinion, he can spend his money on whatever he wants. But there's been a hell of a lot of caroning going on around this topic. And, you know, their goal is, silly as it might sound, to make space tourism a thing. Whereas, you know, let's concentrate really on getting supersonic flight back for you know, the mass populace, like, you know, well, not even a mass populace really, because Concorde was, of course, just for the elites. I'd just like to see where your mind's been spinning with that one.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think it's, well, first of all, let me just say, you know, I don't care about how they spend their own money. I'm very happy for them to launch themselves into space or under the sea or do whatever they want with their own money. However, it's not their own money. These things are government-supported entities. They get a lot of money from NASA and from all kinds of government agencies, which is essentially the only business model that Elon Musk has come up with some fancy story. And in this case, you know, the same people who think, oh, no, the concentration of carbon dioxide on Earth is rising from 0.028% to 0.041%, and that's going to make Earth uninhabitable. And that's why we need electric cars in order to stop emissions, even though electric cars probably make more emissions. These same people will also tell you, yep, we need to move to Mars, where CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is 95%. So the Earth on which we've lived for God knows how many thousands or millions or billions of years, is going to be made inhabitable with, by 0.04% CO2. But Mars, which we've never been to and has enormously high temperatures, is going to be made habitable with a CO2 concentration of 95%. So clearly, you know, this isn't very coherent and consistent, and it's just meant to attract government subsidies. So SpaceX lives off subsidies, and Tesla lives off subsidies and carbon trading scams. But so I don't begrudge them doing whatever they want with their own money, but I think it's... I wouldn't mind people getting into space tourism. I don't think it would interest me, to be perfectly honest. I mean, if money was not an issue, I'm not sure I'd be interested in taking a rocket to space. I would probably consider it only at a point where it becomes highly safe and secure and has been tried commercially. And it's kind of a rule of thumb I have with aviation as well. When I wrote this paper as well, I was looking at the safety record of aviation, and they do mention that safety of aviation has in fact gotten better over time. But the way that it has gotten better, what I find interesting is it's gotten better with commercial aviation, with airliners. But what it has a terrible safety record is private jets and helicopters. That has that is actually quite risky. And I think the reason for that, in my opinion, is that it's... When you're flying a commercial airplane, you're flying between, say, two airports. You're taking one airplane between two airports. The pilots and the co-pilot will have almost certainly been on this route before, and they will have known, they will have done this same landing and the same takeoff before. They have communicated with the same communications tower. Both of the airports would have handled this airplane before. So everything has been done before, everything has a checklist, and you have a massive operation where hundreds of people in both airports and on the airplane, everyone from the steward to the pilot to the gasoline people filling the gas, everybody has been doing this job as a routine, where they have checklists and they do it for a living and they turn up and wake up every morning and do this thing professionally. This is what I like to handle my business to. This is what I like in all things. You know, I think getting in a taxi is probably safer than driving, because the taxi driver is somebody who's been driving for most of their life, much more than you have, and has better experience with it. And I think the same is true in terms of commercial airplanes. So for me, if I was around when airplanes were invented, I'd like to think that I wouldn't have been a negative Kelvin and telling people that it wouldn't be done. But I think I would have been a bit negative about getting onto an airplane. I don't think I would have gotten onto an airplane until the 1930s, even if I'd known about them from 1903. I think I would have had to see commercial aviation take off, and I'd have to see an illustrated high track record, and who knows when I would have done it. So in this case, you know, it doesn't really interest me so much until perhaps it becomes really widely commercially deployed, that it's a matter of routine. You know, the fact that it is taxpayer subsidized, well, or fiat subsidized, I should say, the fact that it is fiat subsidized leads me to think that it's probably a stupid waste. Well, not probably, definitely. Like, if it was a good idea, if there was some commercial value from it, I mean, if you're the richest man in the world and you need 11 minutes and you pay all of this money and you need all these government subsidies in order to get into the space for 11 minutes, doesn't strike me as a viable business model. I know I might be sounding here like the people who would have dismissed the airplane, saying, well, this can only fly at 6 kilometers per hour, 6 miles an hour or whatever, so there's no point, the cars can go faster. Well, the airplanes will get faster, perhaps, but until they do, I'm not really concerned a lot, and I have very strong reasons to suspect that they won't, because it's government subsidized. If this was not government subsidized, then... I would expect that it would improve, but I think it's a boondoggle for people to continue to come up with. Whenever anything is government subsidized, it does not improve over time. It just finds more excuses for getting more funding. I might be wrong, but I think it's quite telling that these people are so detached from reality, in the sense that, yeah, but like, wouldn't you like your private jet to be supersonic? Wouldn't that be a better use of your time, so that you could, you know, fly from LA to New York in under an hour or 2 hours? Wouldn't that be nice? How much time do those people spend on their private jets? But it's politically unpopular to talk about supersonic flight, and so nobody wants to go there. Somehow they managed to make space more politically palatable, I guess, a lot of space. But another point is that, you know, it's been 50 years since we got to space, or 60, 70 years since we got to space, and it's still pretty expensive. It's still at the level where the world's richest man can do it for 11 minutes. Maybe it's just not as technically feasible as many space fans would like to think. And there is a large element of, you know, the I fucking love science cult to space fandom in general, which I find kind of distasteful, which is, you know, people just LARPing science at home, watching TV and hearing what scientists say on TV and then thinking that they're on team science. It's a more pathetic version of being a sports fan. And I say this as a sports fan myself. But like, you know, at least with a sports fan, you do enjoy the experience of watching the game with people and talking about it with people. And there is an element of that. Well, you kind of do that with space. But I think in space, it's kind of like you think that you're one of the players on the team just because you're watching. But I'm definitely not on the on the viewpoint that this is a waste of resources and they should be paying their taxes instead of going to space. I don't care what they do with their money. In fact, I'd like a world of a lot of very rich people trying all kinds of outlandish and crazy things, because that would bring us amazing output from it. But I think I'd much rather not have a world in a fiat world. You know, you have Bezos and Musk and a few crazy billionaires being able to afford this, while everybody else is a wage slave in a 9-to-5 job. I think in a Bitcoin or gold world, Bezos and Musk would be relatively far poorer to the average wage slave, who wouldn't be a wage slave, who would most likely be an entrepreneur and an owner of capital who had spare time. And then instead of, you know, a couple of hundred billionaires trying crazy things, we'd have a couple of hundred million people trying crazy things with fewer resources, but a lot more variation. And I think that would provide us with a lot more richer outputs.
There's just one thing I want to pick up on there, what you said, because I don't think anyone's really done your level of risk analysis of flying a commercial airplane to a private jet or anything else that you seem to look into. You've clearly, like, you know, talking about yourself there, you wouldn't expect someone like you to be an early adopter of anything, as you were explaining. But yet here you are, you wrote the Bible on Bitcoin, you are completely convinced on Bitcoin, you've clearly gone down the risk analysis hole of Bitcoin. I think anybody listening at this point should
I guess the way to square that is the fact that I was actually pretty late to Bitcoin. I heard about Bitcoin pretty early. I think I don't even remember when I first heard about Bitcoin. It was either 2010 or 2011. And I had the, you know, smart ass, not early adopter viewpoint for a very long time before I took into it. So, you know, this might have saved my life in terms of getting into crazy experimental technology in certain ways, but it was definitely also a very expensive mistake by getting into Bitcoin late. I'm earlier than most people for sure, but it's I think the time from hearing about Bitcoin to actually buying your first Bitcoin for me is exceptionally high, which is a painful reminder of my pigheadedness and how expensive it can be.
Love it, mate. Excellent.
Cheers. All right. Well, I think, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I need to get going. So I can't really take many more questions for now or any more questions. I got to run. But thank you very much, guys, for joining. And I will see you next Monday, where we will have Paul Saladino, I believe, in the seminar, right, Peter? Yes. Yes, so we'll be discussing the carnivore diet with Paul. All right. See you guys.